I always wear my mask and wash my hands after going home.
It's a good tuna, but I think I paid too much.
I am the king of the ink.
Welcome to the Japan What Podcast, episode 145. I am your host, Matthew PMBigelow.com. Coming at you from the Tomi Hisacho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan, the armpit of Asia, covering AI markets in Japan, Society 5.0, rising conflict in the Indo-Pacific, depopulation, immigration, and more. I'd like to say thank you for coming on to today's show. I'm very busy, as usual. Just the amount of prep that adds up. Just one at a time thinking, oh, I'd like to cover that. Then before you know it, you got a big old sandwich of information that you just need to cover. We're going to actually begin today with a segment called Japan Society 5.0.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society.
What?
Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom. Society 5.0. A technology-based, human-centered society. The fourth industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example, free us from the stress of...
All right, Japan Society 5.0 is, of course, the government initiative to drag us kicking and screaming into the next New World Order. Whether that means to give up all of our privacy rights and just accept that we will use AI all the time for a human-centered society, or wait for the government bureaucrats in their 70s and 80s to understand what a USB port is, and by the time they do that, we will magically have a new society. That's kind of how they view things. It's an umbrella term for the next wave of technology and society that the government envisions will affect us all. And of course, they want to be shepherds of this technology, you know, people, bureaucrats that have their pants stapled to their chairs. They just love this idea. But the idea that AI is in a quite a bull market right now ain't no shizzle bizzle. 10 years ago, you could say, that's a bunch of hizzle hizzle. But now you're like, oh, give me that busy busy. You know, I want part of that chat GPT money. Who doesn't? I want to know what's going on in those Tesla supercomputers self-driving on the highways. Who doesn't? We're awash in AI news, and it's not stopping. It's just going to keep going. Of course, I spent 5 years in a telecommunications company in Japan, SoftBank, as a teacher studying AI trends, IoT trends, and presenting them for really English learning for engineers and AI engineers and telecommunications engineers, and as well as some of their executive suite there as well. And it's not like I was hitting home runs every day, but by presenting this information to people in the industry, you kind of begin to understand how engineers view the technology, not dreamy people, but the people that have to use their hands to connect users to whatever these services are. Very interesting job. And since then, I've been keeping up with it with this podcast. And that's the Japan What Podcast. Little segment today. We had a much larger Japan Society 5.0 segment on the previous podcast, episode 144. If you're interested, go check it out there. Some more company profiles as well. But again, like I said, there's the idea that these geriatrics in charge are going to be like, whoa, wait a minute, guys, you're going to make it according to our needs, when really it should be up to like the 20 and 30 year olds to just go crazy with this technology, develop as many solutions as they can see fit, and then understand what services those could provide. But no, we have to have people who don't understand thumb drives driving us into this 5.0. Oh. Whoa, hold on a second here. I was just about to pop up in this article, but the website's taking it down. Found another source. You never know what's going to happen in this crazy world. Tokyo, The Japanese government is considering introducing legally binding regulations on developers of large-scale artificial intelligence systems to ensure they implement measures to address disinformation and other risks, sources close to the matter said. While the government has previously leaned towards making such measures voluntarily, it has recognized the need for penal regulation, similar to moves made by the European Union and other countries amid concerns over potential AI misuse. The European Union is falling apart, by the way. Every decision they make is terrible, and they are basically like in the medieval ages, a bunch of guild societies that prevent any innovation from happening because they don't want to lose their status as a guild. And so the EU is just Mr. Regulation or Ms. Regulation at this point. The government plans to convene a council of AI experts. Ooh, they're experts to discuss the, just like in COVID, experts say we need to lock down and close everything. And the issue is considering incorporating the new regulations into economic and fiscal management policy guidelines to be compiled around June. Japan will soon release guidelines listing 10 principles, including human-centeredness and safe AI use. That goes back to the Japan Society 5.0, a human-centered technological society. According to a draft released last month by a project team of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, headed by the most unpopular leader the LDP has ever had, Mr. Kishida, businesses developing advanced technologies such as generative AI will be designated as AI foundation model developers and so on. Basically, the government of Japan seems to be enamored with ChatGPT, which is owned by Microsoft and Bill Gates. And a few months ago, Bill Gates awarded the SDG Keepers Award to Mr. Kishida. So I wonder if there's a little conflict of interest going on there. I don't know. I'm just asking questions. But you have Mr. Kishida meeting Mr. Gates. And Mr. Gates giving Mr. Kishida an award for SDGs. And then, months later, we're going to have guidelines. But it seems to me that the government of Japan is enamored with ChatGPT, which is now owned by Microsoft. I wonder if there's some sort of big club. And I wonder if I'm not in it. Can still ask questions, though. The European Parliament earlier this month passed the world's first comprehensive artificial intelligence act, expected to take effect from 2026 and will impose significant fines for violations. Yeah, guild society. It's the geriatrics in charge that say, oh no, don't innovate, but innovate. Innovate according to our guidelines, which is just made by a bunch of lawyers for a time and period that no longer exists, and that'll be your future. Okay? Now go do that, society. Society 5.0. Screw you. What a bunch of... these guys might just be jerks, I'm thinking. After all of this, my assessment is, I wonder if these guys are not actually technological developers and foresee the future of this use in practical terms. Maybe they're just jerks. Oh, fancy that. We're going to actually take a look at a product here, an application coming to us from Japan. Where did that last one come to us from? Oh, geez. Alt tab, and then one thing leads to another. Got it. All right, this one came to us from Kyoto News. That was actually earlier this month, March 18th, but I haven't been able to cover it because of other issues related to the podcast. But we should be aware of how bureaucrats are aiming to basically steal the technology and make it really shitty. All right, there we go. Next, this one's an interesting one, and it makes sense. Sports. Sports and medicine are two areas of AI and robotics where I'm very bullish on. I'm very bearish on things like emotional readers, because it's how do you get into somebody's head? Maybe if someone's laughing, you can tell they're happy. But how often do you laugh just out of politeness at somebody's bad joke? Now, that doesn't actually mean you're happy or that you're expressing mirth, but the AI would look at that and say, well, you are such a happy person. or somebody who's about to commit suicide, but they don't want to let anybody else know that they're about to commit suicide. So they just put on a happy face. Put on your happy face. And you go out and you say, it's been really nice meeting you today. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Then you go out to your car and you kill yourself. All right. Does the AI would look at me like, well, that person had an 86% happiness rate. Does not compute. So that kind of stuff is dumb, but sports are metrics and medicine is metrics as well. Medicine's a little bit dodgier, but by compiling research together, I believe in certain aspects of AI for medical research, basically because there's so much disparity among professional medics or medicinal practitioners or doctors. You can have doctors that have a very local understanding of, for example, people with a lung disease. And then another doctor that has that same locality that has an understanding of a different disease. If you combine those two things together with the medicines that they're taking, you might be able to understand which combination of medicines are affecting the lungs well versus the other disease not well, something like that. It could lead to a compilation of better accuracy based on the disparate nature of the specificity of doctors, if that makes sense. Not every doctor knows everything about every other doctor. It's quite the opposite. Doctor's done for the day. I'm going golfing. I'm driving my Audi. They're not going like, I'm going to research another medicine. It's like, I've done my due diligence. It's time to have fun. So by compiling their research and their data together, we might have a better breadth of understanding for researching what each specific patient needs to treat their illness. I'm 100% bullish on this, and you can't back me down off that position. You can actually say, well, a lot of medical documentation now is turning out to be bogus. And I would say, well, you need to understand what's bogus and then filter that out using the AI. So the AI would be able to, you would have somebody put in charge of filtering out the bogusness, because there's a lot of bogusness. But in Japan, I wonder how much bogusness there is. And anyway, so I'm gonna boop, jump off that. But sports as well is very good. And I learned this by looking at potential use cases for MMA and IoT and things like that. The metrics used based on online reactions of people watching the sport in real time versus the family members watching the athlete versus the historical data of each fighter in the ring and what their weak points are and what their strengths are. But also what kind of moves often get them taken down. And one person can take, for example, each fighter has a variety of strengths and weaknesses. And one person might have great reach, but a weak jaw. Another person might have a great jaw, but short reach. So by having the person getting hit in the jaw by who has a weak jaw, they would be more susceptible to falling later in the round or something like that. And you compile that over years and years and years of data. And now all of a sudden you have an expert database at your fingertips, something like that. But in this case, it's robots replicate reality. High-tech pitching machines mimic every pitcher. This comes to us from Florida, but we can obviously imagine that Japan, being a baseball-crazy nation, and with its initiatives in Society 5.0, they might be interested in implementing this technology in their training, as long as you have a trainer who's under the age of 97 years old. I've worked at a corporation where the owner, still alive, is in his mid-90s. And let me just tell you the type of, just takes forever to do anything in that type of situation. That person views a 75-year-old as their severe junior. Nestor Cortez got behind the plate in a batting cage and watched an 8-foot-high, 1,200-pound robot spit out fastballs, cutters, and sweepers, just like the ones spinning off the fingertips of his left hands. Quote, "It was like seeing myself pitch. That was crazy," the New York Yankees all-star left-hander said. Technology has come a long way since the days of the pitching machines. I'm just kind of going here. Dodgers two-way star Shohei Ohtani said he used this machine called the Traject to view his pitches from a different vantage point. This article is very poorly written because nobody probably understands what the hell AI is, but you would basically have all of the cameras from the various angles on each pitcher from the entire Major League Baseball League stored and compiled into a database and understand how fast the person pitches, what type of pitch they use, how Shohei Ohtani's fastball is different from whatever else fastball there is out there. And you would program that person into the pitcher, and then you would have all of your batters for a team train against every single pitcher. So instead of having just the trainer decide, okay, today's this pitch, you would program each pitcher to pitch against the person. Now, it's not going to be the exact same pitching style 100%, but it's probably going to get there up to 70, 80, 90%. And then you have this vast variety of different styles of pitches and speeds and styles as well that each batter can now train against. And probably within a couple of years, if this is introduced all throughout the league industry, you're going to see the batters improve remarkably well. I would say this, that you'd have to have the ability to pay $15,000 a month to do so. So this is not going to be your little league in the outskirts of Hiroshima Prefecture using this type of technology. They might afford one and pass it around the prefecture, but who knows if the training is even there for the operator to utilize it correctly, given the amount of elderly people. But yeah, very interesting idea that you could have each pitcher kind of programmed into a pitching machine and train batters against those pitches. Interesting. Next one. That article was so poorly written. I'll be linking it up at MatthewPMBigelow.com. And you just want to read like how it works, but it goes like in 35 different directions. And I worked in mainstream media in Japan from 2020 to 2022. Didn't really work out that way. But every time I had to do like an AI article or look at some AI article, I just knew that the writer, the researcher, the translator, the English person, nobody knew anything about AI. And they just wrote around AI the entire time. It's like, we want to use AI. Who? Well, the government does. Who are they talking to? Experts. What do the experts say? We want to use AI. And there was never actually like, it would be like saying like, hey, here's a new car. How fast does it go? What's the mileage on it? What type of tires does it use? Where are the components from? That would be like some technical, you'd have some guy who knows about cars writing about that. But it was like nobody knew about cars writing about cars. It's like, we have this thing called cars, and the government believes in cars. Let's talk to the car experts. The cars are things that are to be used. And it's just like this whole circumlocution of talking around the issue without ever actually talking about the issue. It's very, very frustrating. All right, well, let's take a look at this next article. New AI traffic project developed in Hungary, Turkey, and Japan. Kind of a trifecta of countries you'd never imagine working on AI traffic together. This comes to us from itsinternational.com. MediaNet's lab in Hungary is developing a traffic congestion forecast and control system that will use AI to control traffic lights. The project, called Multi-Input Deep Learning for Congestion Prediction and Traffic Light Control, Trilico, is being developed with Istanbul IT and Smart City Technologies Company in Turkey and the Nara Institute of Science and Technology in Japan. According to Hungarian media reports, there is no similar solution being tested in real-life situations in any large urban environment in Europe or Japan. A key objective of the project is to run the solution in real traffic conditions in Istanbul. The three-year project will be coordinated by Vilmos Simon, head of MediaNet's lab, which is part of the Department of Network Systems and Services with the Faculty of Electrical Engineering and Informatics at Budapest University, as the university is known, is a public research facility university. This laboratory that's being used specializes in applying AI to smart city environments. The Nara Institute of Science and Technology is a Japanese national university. It focuses on information science, biological sciences, and materials science research. The primary function is to organize joint European-Japanese research calls for proposals and other research-related activities with the aim to enhance cooperation and exchanges between the two regions. Anyways, that sounds like more far-fangled research, and I'm not sure what, like, how would you compare? I've been to all three. I've been in Japan since 2006. I've been to Istanbul. I've been to, what's the other one that's involved here? Hungary. I've been to Budapest. These are very different places with totally different traffic systems. So we'll see what this means. I just thought it was interesting that Japan and Hungary and Turkey are working on real-time AI traffic projects. We'll see where that goes. But that's Japan Society 5.0 for today.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society. Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom. Society 5.0, a technology-based, human-centered society. The fourth industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example, free us from the stress of driving.
All right, we're going to take a look at supply chain and supply chain wars. These are similar and different at the same time. Die for the war, everybody moves. Die for the good, die for the war, die for the war. Couple of things coming to us from Taiwan. The reason the Japan What podcast focuses on Taiwan is that we're going to be expected to come to Taiwan's aid if China tries to reclaim it. China, of course, regards Taiwan as a rogue state. Well, Taiwan regards itself as its own independent democracy. And the United States has this weird bicurious relationship with both of them, where they love business, so they do lots of business with China, and China is deep inside America's systems. It's very good at infiltrating them, but at the same time, the United States feels like it's obligated to protect Taiwan so that China doesn't really expand outside into the Pacific. So because of the relationship between the security apparatus of Japan and the United States, many people are expecting Japan to come to Taiwan's aid in one form or another. And it's heating up, but I also wonder if it's not. So there's just a couple of things that we'll not go too much into, but people should be aware of. Taiwan confirms presence of U.S. Green Berets on islands very close to China's coast. Now, Taiwan is, of course, you know, that is that big island that's called Formosa, beautiful island. And, but there's also a network of smaller islands and islets between mainland China and Taiwan that are administered directly by Taiwan. And some of them run really, really close to China mainland shores. And a couple of those islands, I think, are called the Kinmen Islands. So a report said that the U.S. Green Berets were stationed at the Taiwanese Army's amphibious command centers. The deployment was carried out under provisions in the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act, which called for the U.S. to create a comprehensive training program for the Taiwanese military. The U.S. has significantly increased its military and diplomatic support for Taiwan in recent years, ratcheting up tensions in China. Last year, the U.S. deployed around 200 troops to Taiwan, making the largest known military U.S. military presence on the island since the U.S. pulled its troops out after Washington severed diplomatic relations with Taipei in 1979. Yeah, many people don't know, but until 1979, the U.S. basically had considered Taipei to be China and China itself to not be China, essentially. Very complex relationship there. So like I said, Kinmen is located like 30 miles or about 50 kilometers off of the Chinese mainland, but they're administered by Taiwan. So The idea is that China could begin to salami slice off portions of the islands in the Taiwan Straits belonging to Formosa or Taipei, and then acquire more and more land. And then that would be staging grounds for a future invasion potentially of Taiwan as well. Taiwan training laser weapons on China's drone threat, and how China ended up financing the Houthis' Red Sea attacks. This last one kind of falls into place with the international supply chain wars, where China's One Belt and One Road policy is aiming to upset the maritime world order by making G7 style shipping routes riskier, and thereby making China and Russia and Iranian based routes less riskier for the global South and all of that jazz. But the laser weapons on China's drone threat, there's a vast array of reasonably high-powered laser weapons that are available now. And the idea is that if you could train the lasers to focus on the part of the drones that have the quadricopter style, if you could focus them on where the quadricopter blades meet the drone itself, it's basically comprised of plastic, a high-powered heat laser would be able to melt the rotary or the rotor blades on that to the point where it would destabilize and render it useless very quickly. That's kind of an interesting idea, that you wouldn't need a vast array of bullets or munitions. You would just need lasers and point them at the drones, which would then prevent them from delivering their kinetic strikes against your infrastructure and things like that. I'll be posting links to this. This comes to us from asiatimes.com. I'll be posting links to this at the website for the podcast, matthewpmbigelow.com. Yeah. Well, do you want to shoot lasers at drones? I sure as hell do. That's the future I've been waiting for. I don't know about you. A couple of more issues. We're not going to go too much into it. China, soon to be world's largest air force. They're already probably the world's largest navy. Now they're building up to be the world's largest air force as well. And Japan to build shelters on islands near Taiwan in case of attack. This is the Asahi Shimbun. Why not go into this? A little bit local. Coming to us at the end of March. We're recording this in the beginning of April. This comes to us at the end of March. Japan to build shelters on isles near Taiwan in case of attack. The government disclosed guidelines for the construction of underground shelters on outlying islands in Okinawa Prefecture in case of a military crisis involving Taiwan. The program follows a shift in defense posture that has seen the self-defense forces, Japan's de facto military, moving anti-aircraft missile batteries and surface-to-ship missile launchers to the Nansei chain of islands that extend in a southwesterly direction from the main southern island of Kyushu. But the leaders of municipalities in some of the more remote islands complain that the preparations placed residents at greater risk of coming under attack if China follows up on its threats to move on Taiwan. For example, Yonaguni town is only about 110 kilometers from Taiwan. When Yonaguni mayor Kenichi Itokazu held talks last July with Hirokazu Matsuno, who was then chief cabinet secretary, he called for more government support to assuage the concerns of residents over the SDF setting up bases in the islands. But they might need them, and they might need them to hide from the vast array of refugees that are going to get into boats from Taiwan and sail up the island chains and claim refuge in Kyushu, or might even go up into into Shikoku area. There's a major concern that a lot of these refugees might also be Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy officials posing as Taiwanese people. The Japanese people don't really understand the difference between the languages spoken on Taiwan and the languages spoken in mainland China, Mandarin and Cantonese. Nobody really knows that. And somebody who speaks, I guess, Cantonese might know a few sentences in Mandarin and probably trick almost 99% of the Japanese people into thinking that they're mainland Chinese, or they could switch back into Cantonese. I don't know what language they speak in Taiwan, by the way, and spoof them that way. So it's not like the Japanese people have some sort of way of testing to understand who is a refugee and who is not a refugee. But these shelters could also be used to house the refugees. Who knows about that, huh? These are the things that we have to consider amid such times. Again, who considered this in advance in the Donbass area between Ukraine and Russia? Maybe a few people did, but was it taken to the extent where you would build underground bunkers and shelters? Maybe if you were in 2020 or in 2019 in the Donbass region and you built yourself an underground bunker, you'd be pretty happy right now, wouldn't you? But and now we have to think about these things. What's coming up? What's China going to do? We don't know. The main thing for today's war segment, though, and this is something I've been building on for quite a while here, this is the idea of the supply chain war. We are in a supply chain war, most definitely. The Chinese style versus the American style. And up until now, the American style supply chain has been guaranteed by the American Navy. And we have this great infrastructure of goods that free flow across all oceans, all over the world, delivering products to our doors that we click on the internet. It's pretty amazing. But China doesn't just want to be the manufacturer. They want to own the platforms as well. They want to own the companies, and they also want to own the currency that is involved with such shipping. So right now, China produces all the goods, and it buys all the fuel. Not all the fuel, but it owns these major shipping lines, and it has to pay petrodollars to gain such fuel. And then international exchange uses, by and large, up until this point, the U.S. dollar. But with the weaponization of the U.S. dollar, that is a weak point in the usage for the U.S. dollar, because many people look at what happened to Russia and the sanctions that go on there after the U.S. waged war for 20, 25 years across the Middle East. And they kind of go, this is unfair. We don't really trust this system anymore. And we believe there's new technologies afoot that allow us to trade independently with each other without the reliance on the U.S. dollar. There's also the aspect of, is the U.S. military prepared to defend everybody that is promised to defend? Likely not. Look what's happened in Afghanistan and so on and so on. It goes on from there. So basically, there's the idea of China taking its own initiative with the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a network of belts that incorporate maritime trade routes, road trade routes, and train routes to deliver Chinese goods to people that want them using Chinese smartphones via the Huawei networks that also control the AI ships that they want to envision. And for example, I use this example a lot. Some farmer is selling coffee beans in Africa. Some buyer wants to buy them in Beijing. They connect via their Chinese smartphones. They place the order. It's tracked by the government. Some exchange gets made, the e-yuan, the Chinese CBDC, and then that order is logged, and a ship filled with other orders goes from Beijing or from Zhangzhou or whatever it is down through the maintaining the AI beltways. The ships are driven by themselves, essentially, and into a port in Africa, or unmanned port. It's like a robot port. And then those containers are loaded onto trains owned by China. They go up into a village, and then the farmer in that village puts his coffee as part of the containment or the container process. And then it goes back and all the way through to Beijing. So everybody's happy. Nobody uses dollars. Everybody's using Chinese technology and it works and everybody's hunky-dory. That's the Chinese vision of their future of hegemony for naval dominance. And they are using the weaknesses in the G7 systems with the fixation on rights and LGBTQ. All of that stuff takes up such a massive amount of our time that we're not able to really defend our supply chain networks to the ability that we can. And China might even be doing that in a way. So all of that aside, it leads up for this idea that the G7 DAO is focused on green supply chain networks, and they just want people to be green, and we need to be green and green and green and green. And Japan's doing its best by developing hydrogen-based technologies and batteries and fuel cell and all that, hoping to be green. But is it really going to compete against the Russia, China, Iran system, which focuses on results, which is the main thing? So, okay, we have pollution, but we have results. On the other side, we have no pollution, but we don't have any results. These are the type of two scenarios that are playing right now. So let's take a look at this article here. And this is the supply chain war. This comes to us from the Mainichi.jp, Japan's national daily since 1922. And Japan eyes rules for firms to disclose greenhouse gas emissions data. And this is going to tie into the carbon credit scheme that Japan is basically a major part of. Japan's financial watchdog is considering obliging companies listed on top-tier section of the Tokyo Stock Exchange to disclose information on greenhouse gas emissions throughout their supply chains. This is Agenda 2030. This is the SDGs. This is the ESGs. Forcing their way into the supply chains. And if you're part of the G7, if you're like me, a Canadian living in Japan, well, welcome to the new administration state. This is what they want for us. The Financial Services Agency will set up a panel this month to work out the details of the envisioned policy in support of global efforts to accelerate decarbonization, according to its plan proposed at a meeting of the Financial System Council. One option would be to first target major firms facing increasing scrutiny by global institutional investors rather than applying the envisioned rule to all of the roughly 1,600 companies listed on the prime market at once, according to the government. Japan is seeking to develop sustainability disclosure standards based on those unveiled in 2023 by the International Sustainability Standards Board, a global body that sets financial reporting rules. The country's draft standards are expected to be released by the end of March, which is where we are now. In a survey of roughly 1,300 companies conducted last year by research firm Teikoku Data Bank, 17.3% said decarbonization efforts would have a negative impact, while 14.1% responded operations would be positively impacted. The remaining companies said they expected little impact or were not sure. So even they don't really know what's going on. So they want to have, basically, Japan is establishing a carbon credits scheme, and they want their own companies to kind of be listed into this scheme so that more data is put into this scheme so that we can financialize our way out of the current economic catastrophe that everybody keeps talking about is going to be here. We have international experts exchange views on use of international carbon credits. Hold on, optimize the entire, we have some other things here. I'm trying to figure out what it means. Oita forestry firm signs carbon trade deal with line operator. And this goes to the idea that we also have within the supply chain networks dealing with major countries around the world, not major countries, but major production countries around the world that are very third world. They have almost no money of themselves. And we're expecting them to not only reduce their carbon emissions, but improve the amount of females on their board networks. And then also have those companies be all in on the reduction of pollution worldwide, according to the standards that are being set by advanced countries that are experiencing population decline run by geriatrics that really don't know what anybody else is doing, but they kind of have this feeling that they should be telling everybody else what they should be doing. So as a result, are we seeing in the G7, which affects me, which affects you, in the supply chain war, more product being moved into supply chains that get results, whether they pollute more or not? The Russia, the China, the Iran. For example, the Côte d'Ivoire, one of the major production centers of cocoa in the world, Do you think this country gives a shit about carbon credit schemes for their cocoa? So they want to sell the cocoa, but do you think that this country is just going to say, we're just going to sell it to China, who's going to buy it all anyways and come with their ships and just leave and maybe even potentially give us a huge amount of 5G equipment that we can use and for free, but we don't care if they know everything about our citizens because we don't have to pay for it? Or do you think that these countries that produce things like cocoa are going to be like, nope, we not only do we believe in LGBTQ rights in the third world country of Cote d'Ivoire, but we're also so loyal to the G7 that we will just never talk to anybody else who has any other financial remuneration project involved in international trade? You know, the answer is a lot of people are going to flee the G7 with these ideas that they're going to have hydrogen plants when they don't even have roads, all this stuff. Everyone is panicking. Major cocoa processor scrambles to find beans as prices hyperinflate. Did you know that the price of cocoa is more than the price of copper right now per ton? This comes to us from ZeroHedge.com. One of the world's largest cocoa processors is scouring the globe for beans as weather and diseases spark massive crop failures across West Africa and catapult prices in New York to record highs. I actually disagree with that. I would imagine that cocoa producers might even be saying, oh, look at all this global warming. We just don't have any beans for you. Well, they sell all the beans to China. Everybody is panicking, said Brandon Teho Liang, chief executive officer at Guangzhou Build. He said the company is attempting to procure beans from minor growing countries, including Ecuador, Peru, and Indonesia. The CEO of the Kuala Lumpur-listed company said prices are soaring weekly as coca beans become harder and harder to find. Guangzhou's processing plant is still operating normally, despite the world heading for a third year of supply deficits, primarily due to crop failures across West Africa. Again, I'm not sure if these are crop failures. Maybe because of the COVID lockdowns and all the supply chain disruptions, that led to massive disruptions in the supply chain as well. It could be just environmental. You could just say it's global warming, but at the same time, the rulers of this corrupt country could just also say, guess what? Global warming. We don't have anything for you. Now get out of here. As the China ship pulls up with massive cargoes full of 5G equipment that get unloaded, and then those cocoa products get put on the ship to China. And then the G7 prices go up and up and up and up and up, and we go, where are all the beans? We don't know. They've been bought. They've just gone somewhere else. City Research, and I'm willing to be completely wrong on this, but this is an example of where it could go with the G7 just insisting and being so pushy-shovey with everything that they do, whereas it's like, okay, we're gonna come with our dirty ships and we're going to take your cocoa and we're going to give you money. And they're going to be like, we don't care if you have dirty ships. Look at our place. The entire country's dirty. City Research Analysis recently advised clients that prices could reach as high as $10,000 a ton and stay in record high territory through the second half of 2025. Hershey Company warned historic cocoa prices are expected to limit earnings growth this year. So anyways, that's that idea. And again, I don't think it's global warming. I don't really believe in global warming. I think global warming is largely a sham. And if it is, we're screwed anyways. I think it's mismanagement as a result of the global shutdown of the economy because of COVID. Or it's in addition to the mismanagement, all the extra product is just being sold to China, who's going to take it with an exchange of money and no fuss, no muss. And this also goes into the olive oil prices are going up as well. If you don't know about olive oil, and I had somebody from Portugal, I believe, who contacted me, who had listened to the podcast or reviewed the notes at MatthewPMBigelow.com. And he said that a lot of the olive oil in the supermarkets where he's at, was it Spain or Portugal, are locked up. Like the prices went way up, theft went way up. So they locked it up, just like what they're doing in California. The world of coffee is being reordered by EU laws to stop cutting of forests. This comes to us from Japan Today, and it's still up. At the end of March, we're recording this at the beginning of April. I'm not going to go too much into this, but this is saying that the EU is rewriting laws and imposing a whole bunch of regulations and restrictions where you have to provide massive amounts of evidence that your coffee is essentially green in order to sell it into the EU. Or those people that are making coffee don't have to sell to the EU or provide any of their data and supply it to China. And they can sell hundreds of tons into China without the rigmarole of appeasing these EU overlords. That'll be up at MatthewPMBigelow.com. And if this is about Vietnamese sellers as well. So Vietnamese is a massive producer of coffee beans. And do you think the Vietnamese care if their coffee beans end up in the cafes of Paris or the cafes of Beijing? Have you ever been to Beijing and had their coffee there? It's amazing. It's really good. I'm a coffee snob. Beijing nails it these days. So the idea that Vietnam is going to, well, we can just send our coffee up right like a couple of 100 miles north. And everyone's like, yeah, but China's not going to be really regarding your human rights. So you got to prove to us that you're not cutting down any forests so that we get your beans. Yeah, I think a lot of people are just saying, screw you, actually. There's other options out there. We're going to take the other option. And a lot of this stems into the idea of international carbon credits. So by establishing EU regulations that say forests are not being decimated, therefore you can put companies into a carbon credit scheme. Oh, these companies are good and they get carbon credits because they are not cutting down their forests to produce their goods. And that also creates carbon sinkholes, which means we can invest in those areas and offset our carbon emissions. So you have a forest, we have a factory, we'll just buy parts of your forest and kaboom, we're magically now not producing pollution according to our carbon credit schemes. So this comes to us from FocusTaiwan.tw. Joyce Go, commercial director of Singapore's carbon exchange Climate Impact X, said Singapore uses the mechanism of a carbon tax to control the country's emissions, and carbon tax liable companies can offset up to 5% of their taxable emissions with international carbon credits. And at the Global Carbon Credit Forum held on the last day of the Net Zero City Expo, international experts outlined the local audience the frameworks and practices of different carbon credit markets in Europe, Japan, Singapore, and China. A point of overlapping focus in the discussion was the use of carbon credits from the international voluntary carbon market, meaning credits developed voluntarily out of carbon-reducing projects, and each country's own carbon pricing system to offset emissions. An expert on the Tokyo Stock Exchange Carbon Credit Market Office, did you know that existed? The Carbon Credit Market Office in the Tokyo Stock Exchange? That's no joke, people. Saki Kawabuto said the Japanese government has aims for both carbon emissions reduction and economic growth. Quote, the government would hesitate to accept international credits, which are believed to have little to contribute to the domestic economy in the mandatory carbon pricing scheme. And Japan has so far not established a mandatory compliance pricing credit scheme requiring major emitters to reduce emissions or pay carbon tax, and its current J credit system encourages enterprises to set their own targets and trade the emissions, according to Kawabuto. So we can see that in the supply chain war, we are beginning to witness the emergence of these aspects of clean supply chain networks where you trade and your carbon credits and you do all this and you don't cut down forests. So that encourages you maybe to put your product onto a carbon credit list or to be in compliance with a carbon credit list. It's there's like this green eco compliance mechanism where you can trade on it. It becomes tokenized. It becomes something that you can put into an environmental financial scheme, if you will. And we also have a couple of things before I get into the one. It's like Taiwan's Smart City Summit and Expo 2024. It attracts global carbon trading leaders. So Taiwan fighting against the Chinese, but they're also, you know, they also want to be part of the global carbon trading schemes. How do you trade carbon anyways? How is this thing? It's an imagined thing that doesn't even exist. And you try to present this to people and they go, well, I have a forest and you have a factory, so you give me money, and then that means basically my carbon sink becomes your carbon offset, and that reduces the pollution. Like, well, it might not reduce the pollution, but it creates a carbon trading credit scheme. Don't you see? And a lot of people are going to go, just going to go with the money, please. And China seems to be delivering that. And a company within Japan that could be on the verge of being used for this, albeit with the sources I'm using, are within perhaps not the most direct linear connection. It's not a collocation I'm using, yes, and, or so, but this comes to us from foodonline.com. NEC, which is a Japanese tech company, very proficient at computer vision and facial recognition, and Sumitomo Corporation signed strategic partnership agreement to expand global sales of the Crop Scope Agricultural ICT platform. NEC Corporation and Sumitomo Corporation have signed a strategic partnership agreement to expand global sales of NEC's agricultural ICT platform, Crop Scope. Based on this, this says, since population, I'm going to actually go to a different article because this one is, we don't have enough time. CropScope innovates agricultural operations with digital agricultural utilizing AI and data analytics. Concept, centralization. Consolidate crop growth and farming environment data in one platform. Users can share variable information in real time with all stakeholders. That's the key word there. So basically what this is it's a platform that uses AI and data analytics to analyze what farms are doing. CropScope provides, this is the name of the company, CropScope provides necessary functions for farming in one service. So data is not separate into different places. It's using translation AI. A variety of data can be aggregated into one service and linked with each field information for management. Users can keep track of field-specific information without using multiple devices or apps and share work records and insights among stakeholders by instantly linking them to each field. CropScope delivers globally for various crops, and it says alert messages with abnormally location brings you to exact points in large areas. It combines cameras, analytics, soil, and everything. This is an advanced network of analytics and surveillance technology to put on farms all over the world. Now, what if you're a farm in Vietnam that pledges not to cut down your forests and you start cutting down your forests? If this program is trained on your forests, they're going to know about it in real time. So Sumitomo has a network of regional organizations in 65 countries around the world and is engaged in sales and distribution of agricultural materials such as agrochemicals and fertilizers in about 40 countries. Through this partnership, Sumitomo will utilize its global network to expand CropScope's sales areas to Thailand, Brazil, and India, aiming for business growth. Future developments. Sumitomo has been focusing on developing new businesses that contribute to sustainable food production with high efficiency and low environmental impact by utilizing advanced technologies in addition to expanding its existing business base in the agricultural and food fields. One of the important themes is smart farming, which contributes to the realization of safe and highly efficient food production by utilizing such technologies as automation. So you can kind of see here that this platform that Japan has this exchange for carbon credits. Japan is deep in the America G7 style next wave of hydrogen or clean energy, so-called clean energy supply chain networks. And they also want to have their own, it's basically surveillance technology installed across farms around the world, possibly to even maintain or as a form of soft power, encourage a separation, the separation, the ongoing separation of the Chinese style, one belt, one road based on results and preserve farms and everybody else to get convinced into this weird green cult mentality of monitoring everything so that we don't cut down anything, so that we have carbon trading going on, so that we have a so-called green future. But it's none of it's been realized. None of these results have come to fruition, but they're all in on it anyways, because they're dying to meet these 2030 goals to end poverty by 2030. That's the SDG goals, and that's what they've all signed on to, it seems. So the supply chain war not only entails like the war not only entails things like the Middle East and Ukraine and the drone development technology, although it does, but a larger focus is on the future of the supply chain networks. And there are two major focuses coming on right now. Which one is going to win? The one that's based on the Chinese renminbi, AI, automation, and results, or the one that's based on hydrogen, G7, carbon trading? And one is based in, I view the Chinese model more based in reality, and the G7 one based in a reality many people that I don't know would like to envision for I don't know who in the future. And these are two major programs that are going on right now. And when we see things like olive oil going up, and when we see things like coffee going up, well, if you can't expand your crops, or if you can't move your crops, or if you can't adjust your crops during times of weather change, climate change, whatever you want to call it, how do you expect the management systems to also move with these changes in real time when they are so centralized by international trading organizations that really have nothing to do with reaching that type of reach and scope as they have before? Those are major points that we are looking at into the future, and it's only going to go that way because the die has been cast, the Rubicon has been crossed, and we're all in this together, whether you like it or not.
Die for the war, everybody moves. Die for the good, die for the war, die for the war.
So you found it. The Japan What Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. Make sure to go to MatthewPMBigelow.com. That's MatthewPMBigelow.com or PayPal.me/JapanWUT. Also check out a modern podcasting app, Podcasting 2.0. Send me some Bitcoin. I need it. I also need your traffic over at the website, MatthewPMBigelow.com. You can't help me enough. Who else is doing this analysis? Nobody. That's who. So thank you very much. Until then, till next time, I wish thee a very heartful and a very warmful ja mata ne.